Welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are juicing the rhetorical oranges, seeing what kind of tasty concoctions we can whip up. I don't know, Orange Julius Caesar. That's around the maybe semantic slushy. We're squeezing the juices. Here we go. I'm Dr. Dan, PhD in rhetoric, late night comedy writer, stand up. I'm a rhetorician, comedian, rhetormedian, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. We are out here teaching the people about ethical rhetoric, which I could probably talk to this guy about a lot, but I won't. On the podcast, I do a few things. I talk to comedians about their politics, and I let them do bits that they cannot do in comedy clubs because of politics. I convert conservatives on the podcast because the right fascinates me and it's fun. I chat with people who have causes, want to get them out in the world, and I talk to persuasion pros and rhetoricians. More rhetoricians on this podcast than any other podcast you'll hear today. This is another episode of the Rhetorician Files, which is a sub-channel within podcast, Rhetoric Warriors podcast, where I just talk to academic rhetoricians. Today, my buddy is Dr. William Keith, longtime worker in the rhetorical academic minds. This guy's been in universities forever. I knew him in grad school at UT Austin, and then we randomly ended up teaching together at the U of Lou in Louisville. He has a book out, Beyond Civility, the Competing Obligations of Citizenship. My friend, Bill Keith.
Hey, how you doing, man? I'm having a little hallucination here that you're like Joe Rogan with no tattoos. Is that correct?
I get a little of that. You know, the bald guy, muscles. Yeah. Hopefully
I'm very smart.
I'm up. Right? Hope I'm just a ledge above Rogan in, you know.
The totally classier. Seeking the audience, but let's get there.
Well, he's in Austin now. He moved to Austin, so I'm sure to run into him at some point. Yeah, he brought a bunch of comedy store ilk, like kind of aggressive, hardcore, you know, on the edge, shocky comedians into Austin, and it's completely decimating the community.
Isn't it like Alex Jones too? Isn't he there?
I don't know, man. Everybody says they live in Austin. They'll be here for a couple years and move.
I do not live in Austin. I live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Which, despite what you may have heard on ESPN, is not a shit town. It is not a hot mess. It's a great town.
They went after ESPN went after Milwaukee?
Well, you know, the playoffs are going to be here because we have this little basketball team called the Bucks. And they made it pretty far. And so, yeah, people are talking about ESPN about how they don't want to have to travel there because, oh, God, you have to go to Milwaukee.
It's like I played rugby at against Marquette, man. I had a great time in Milwaukee.
And you know, when you were there, what's his name? Jeffrey Dahmer lived right off campus. You know, he was doing some of his best work right there.
Come on. You got a city at that point. If you've got a serial killer, you've got a city.
True, true. And not just any serial killer, right?
No, he's got to be top five.
Cannibalism is really, you know, it's one of the top level things, I think.
Although, you know, if you follow the headlines coming out of Germany and stuff, there's like one every other week in Germany, some cannibal serial killer.
We can't really compete, but we had Ed Gein, and Ed Gein launched 1,000 movie franchises. So
I watched, you know, Mindhunter. I watched it. That was, did you watch that series?
No.
Pretty good. It's pretty well done.
Yeah. I do know that there's a county in, Central Wisconsin, where you can go into a bar and ask for a Giener, and they'll give you a beer with no head.
Damn, that is good. That is well done. Way to go.
Now Pete. That we've started off classy, let's ramp it up here.
It's rhetoric. You can talk about it wherever you want, right? So run your background a little bit. Like I said, you've been in academics forever. How did you get into academics? What grabbed you and pulled you into the bog of rhetoric?
Well, the rhetoric part was accidental. The academia part was on purpose. So I went to college, and strangely enough, I was a philosophy major. And I chose that, even though I had no idea what it meant, right? Like, so it was one of these like stupid things that an 18-year-old does. And the philosophy department at this school, shout out to Bowling Green State University in Ohio, great school. They didn't have a lot of majors. Yeah, you have, right? Rugby.
University of Dayton, we went everywhere.
But they didn't have a lot of philosophy majors, so they took a lot of care of the ones that they had. And I got a lot of attention from faculty. It was really great. And then the last term of my senior year, they had this visiting person every year that would come in. And this guy, the year I was a senior, was Miles Brand. And so he, whose name you might actually know, because he went on to be president of the University of Oregon, and then he was president of the NCAA for about 10 years before he passed away, right? Yeah. Well, he started out life as a plain old analytic philosopher. And so he teaches a seminar, and I was one of two undergrads that sat in on it. And he comes and he goes, well, I got a new book. We got 10 weeks. I got 10 chapters. Let's go. And so this was not aimed at me. I was not saying I could follow up, but I watched this whole thing and I'm like, so this is what you people do for a living? Oh my God, I think I could do this. So I got super interested, and that got me into the master's program. And then when I was a master's student, the American Philosophical Association, the, you know, the organization for academic philosophers, in my second year sent me a letter and said, please don't get a PhD in philosophy because there are no jobs for you.
Really? You were warned off.
They still sent this letter out. Then they were overproducing PhDs by like a factor of three, and now it's only about 1.5, but still it's not good. But I was warned off, and I went to my teachers. I'm like, what? And they're like, no, it's kind of true. And so I had taken classes in rhetoric as part of being interested in philosophy of language and stuff. And my wife, whom you know, was in this master's program in communication there. And the communication people are like, oh, we all get jobs. This is super easy. I'm like, well, how different could it be? So my wife and I started applying to PhD programs together, and that was the turn into rhetoric. Had I but known. Actually, I'm not
come on, you've gotten jobs. You've never been.
I've always had a job. It's always been about the job. And I've had a job ever since I graduated, sometimes by the skin of my teeth, but not everybody can say that with a PhD. But I'm not sorry to have been in rhetoric. I think it's been a great thing, and a great thing for me. And it's amazing how many great things happen to you in your life that are just like sort of accidental in a certain way. And you just like, you cannot. That's why I think people just need to be open to the weird shit that happens to them, because sometimes it's bad, but a lot of times it's good. You just don't know it yet. Either that, or we're all rationalizers who look back over our life story and construct a version of it where it all makes sense, even though it really didn't.
I like the first one better. I like the first option. Totally. Like I typically just open doors and step into the room and go, what's going on in here? And
no, you definitely walk through life backwards. You know what's happened, but you don't know what's coming. Ass first into life. Absolutely. So, you know, we ended up at Texas together. I think you were in the MA program. We crossed over. My last year was your first year of your MA, yeah. I think.
Yep.
Like that. And then somehow we ended up at the U of L together a couple of years later. That great institution.
Speaking of warning offs, I remember you were one of the first grad students that I talked to. They had you and Kari talk to the new grad students for some reason or another. And I remember your advice. I remember you saying, you can't do anything else. Never fall behind on the reading because you will never catch up again.
That's kind of true.
Yeah, that's good advice.
It's amazing how many grad students, especially once people get in the PhD range, they're like, oh my God, how do I keep up the reading? What am I supposed to do? Right. And it's like, I have a canned talk on how to deal with this.
Yeah, you told me. You got me. I was like, okay, I never fell behind on the readings.
And as an undergraduate, I think you may have.
No. Undergrad was easy. There wasn't that much reading. Come on.
Yeah, you didn't have to do that much. Yeah, but so, and the U of L, and you heard what happened to Shirley Willingance, right?
I know that name. I kind of can place her face, but that's about it.
She taught in the department there. She became provost, and she was provost for, I think, about 15 years. And then about 2 years ago, she resigned in disgrace.
What'd she do?
Guess which part of the university the problem was connected to. Could it be athletics?
Ah, she was providing cover.
She was profiting somehow from it. I don't know. I don't remember if it was one of the sex things or the money things, because there's a bunch of sex and money things, but that whole thing was just like out of control.
Yeah. I tutored, you know, at U of L and UT Austin in the academics. So
I did as well. When I was in grad school, they paid $7.50 an hour, which is like three times the minimum wage at that time.
So many good memories of the basketball players at U of L. Like, what was that guy's name? I can't remember, but he started as a freshman. He would have made the NBA. He had a great shot as a forward and was in my public speaking class, and never came a day. And about halfway through the season, they assigned an assistant coach to bring him to class. the assistant coach brought him, sat there with him, and then went outside to get a drink of water or something. They got bolted. I was like, dude.
Well, you got to feel bad. This guy had no business being in college. If there was a minor league of basketball.
Yeah, he had no interest.
See, now he'll be able to come and get paid. We'll be all good.
There you go. It's all fixed.
That's right. And there was Felton. Did you know Felton Spencer?
Of course I did. He was great.
He was great. He was a really good student. Like he was a straight on B student. And I asked one of the coaches once, like, so why is he so different from all the other players? And they're like, oh, have you not met his mother? He's afraid of his mother.
Ah.
And she told him that if he didn't graduate in 4 years, he couldn't play for the NBA. So he actually took intensive German in the summer and he did all this stuff. And they had this going away party I was invited to. His mother was 6'7".
Wow.
Can you imagine being a little kid and looking like that?
That's awesome.
You'd be terrified. Even though he was a legit 7 feet, I'm sure the terror stays with you.
I'm going to find that guy. I really liked him. He was one of my favorites.
So he finished his career with the Jazz.
He blew his knee out. Facebook. Like he was going to be an all-star, and he blew his knee out like in year four.
I don't know. He started with the Timberwolves, and then he had like an okay career with the Jazz, lasted about 10, 12 years.
I didn't think he lasted that long. I thought he was doing well.
He did. He was at least 10 years with the Jazz.
Okay.
And I believe he still lives in the Salt Lake Valley. But he's on Facebook. You can find him.
I will.
I contacted him once. He totally remembered everything.
Oh, he would remember because I used to joke all the time. Like I remember shaking his hand. He was the first 7-footer I think I met, shaking his hand and just his, you know, his fingers coming almost,
the
you know,
paw.
And I'm like, dude, he's like, yeah, no, I'm not human.
Is there anything I can do to improve my grade?
He was solid. He's one of the best athletes ever had.
Talk about athleticism. Watching him fold himself into a tablet desk.
Yeah.
Was a miracle. How he ever fit inside this thing. I don't know, but he had like sort of 5 moves he would do to get into it.
Yeah, crazy. All right, so University of Louisville, and then you went to Western.
No, first Western. So Pittsburgh, Western, Louisville, and then I was at Oregon State for 10 years. Go Beavers. Right? Everybody has a hand gesture, right?
So go.
Yeah.
Is that a beaver teeth?
Yeah, I think that. Well, if you can be Longhorns, you can be Beavers, right?
Sure.
There's no like duck symbol for University of Oregon, but I feel like there should be a hand gesture. And actually Oregon State is really weird, right? Because the mascot is the beaver. And when you first get there, everything is hilarious. Beaver spirit, beaver pride, beaver this, beaver that. And you get immune to it and you forget how other people are going to hear it. And then they start laughing. You're like, oh, that's right.
Oh yeah. 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 That's right.
And I had a grad student who was raised kind of in the wilderness. It's a very small community of a very dense religious, and he had not been exposed to modern culture at all. And so at one point he's listening and I'm telling this story and he goes, what's funny about beaver?
Bam.
Like,
there you go.
I'm like, of course you wouldn't.
Learning moment.
It's a vulgar word for the female genitalia. He goes, oh, why? I'm like, I'm out. I have finished my duty here. not gonna
good
go
call.
There.
Good call by Professor Keith. Good call.
Yeah, and then when it was a chance to get back to the Midwest, like, man, you're a friggin' traitor. I love the Midwest, and you know, I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, and Milwaukee is just Cleveland with a lake on the wrong side. It's more German, less Polish, but it's not that different. And so it felt very homey. And so when this job came up here, we decided we'd rather be back. And now, given forest fires, earthquakes, climate change, water depletion, living next to the world's largest body of fresh water seems like a smart move. One day you will be coming to my house asking for a drink of water.
Yeah, you guys are in the center of the burning donut.
Pretty much. We can have the harsh winter. That happens.
That is why I am not above the Mason-Dixon line. That is those harsh winters.
Give it 20 years and we won't anymore. What's really weird is now it's like going like this. And so it's either a mildish, not totally, but mildish, or horrifyingly 10 below, 20 below, right? There's no intermediate winters anymore. It's weird.
So I see you as a traditional rhetorical scholar.
What the hell is that?
Like, I did postmodernism. I did pop culture. I studied entertainment. You know, I kind of went up into the whatever fluffy fireworks I could find in rhetoric. And you stood in the hardcore civil discourse, you know, citizenship, all that kind of stuff. Like you, to me, are like a traditional rhetorical scholar?
In a way, yes. In a way, no. Right. Like, so radicalism comes in different flavors.
I'm not saying you're mundane or boring or bland.
Right. No.
Or vanilla or white or whatever you are. I'm just saying.
Well, so the real traditional thing is people who study speeches. Sure. And I never had a class in that. I never did that.
Nobody That's does that anymore, though, right? That doesn't even exist anymore. Who does that?
Not that many people. There's still people that do it, and there are people who teach classes on it and stuff, but that was what configured like what the traditional career was for a long time, and I wasn't interested. So part of me was always about science, about how you take science as a kind of a cultural intellectual formation and say, what are the rhetorical aspects of this? And that's devolved into now I run a class for engineering students.
Nice.
Called Writing, Speaking, Technoscience in the 21st Century, in which I totally upend all their ideas about how science works in society. And they are just amazed and mostly pleased. They like learning their technical stuff and they're very proud of that. But they, it turns out once you started, have a hunger for seeing a larger context for what they do. And then the other part of me is really about public argument. And so that's the part I think that you find kind of traditional, and there's more and less traditional ways of doing that. And part of me took a long detour. I was in, so the National Endowment for the Humanities runs these summer seminars. And so they have like 10 of them every year, and you apply and get accepted. And you go to some campus for 4 weeks, and then you meet 4 hours every day. And each week they bring in one or two superstar academics, and there's readings. You're supposed to spend the afternoon getting the readings done. And then you spend the evenings, you know, socializing with the other people there. And then you get up and you do it all over again. And I was at this thing, and there are a bunch of people there. I don't know if you know Habermas, Jürgen Habermas, the German philosopher, and they had studied with him.
He was there? I was going to say.
But his students were there.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So the Haber Mafia is what we used to call it. And they think that, you know, he basically has the final theory of public discourse, and that everything that could be said was said by him. And for some of it, I was pushing back and saying, no, that's actually not true. A lot of that stuff was being taught in my field decades ago. They're like, no, it couldn't be true. And it just kind of got me pissed off. So I go back to the library and it's like, I'm going to prove this. So I go back and I start looking for older pedagogic materials, you know, textbooks and stuff from the 20s, 30s, 40s. And somehow this is one of those like crazy things. I'm looking for something in the library at Oregon State, and there's like a folder in there. And why is there a folder in there? I pull it out, and it's the speeches of a guy named John Studebaker, who was the US Commissioner of Education in the 1930s and 40s, talking about public forums and educating America to the public forums. I'm like, holy crap, I have hit the gold mine. What is this? And that resulted in the book from 2007 called Discussion as Democracy. And so essentially, you know, what do people think public discourse is, right? Like, so they, is it like a seminar, you know, a grad seminar where people sit around a table and throw things back and forth? It's not really like that. Is like the people on TV yelling at each other? No. It's pretty much disconnected in space and time. So you have stuff flying around and people responding, but what is your model of communication for this? That was the question that I wanted to be able to answer. And so people in the 1930s had a really definite idea, and it wasn't debate. They thought debate represented the worst instincts, you know, pro, con, for, against. It's agonistic, it's conflictive. There's only two options. Like, we can do better than this. We could be problem solvers. And so the discussion movement was born. And discussion was a class taught in universities all over the country. Do you know what it's called now? Small group communication.
It mutated nice.
In the 1950s and became small group process or small group communication.
Science, originally, once again, restricts and kills rhetoric.
To an extent. Well, people's views of it evolved, but in the 1930s and 40s, they thought it was the training for democracy, and that there was this system of public forums that would just keep expanding. And rather than thinking people could only participate through voting, people would just go to these forums and do all this stuff. And then, well, the short story is then TV came along. In the 1930s, going to the forum, hearing people talk on the stage and then talking from the audience, getting all dressed up, that was a night out. That was a good time. People loved it. By the 1950s, that was not seeming like such a good time anymore. Lots of things changed, but that was a big part of it. So I was very interested in that. And there's a successor to that project, which may be coming in the next couple of years. The 1960s, by the 1960s, we're talking about self-actualization and the human potential movement. And I kind of, I came in as an undergraduate at the very end of what people used to call the pillow and blanket stuff. Were you ever exposed to any of that? Uh-huh. We're going to sit on the floor in a circle and share with each other, and a lot of self-disclosure and this kind of stuff. And people became very embarrassed by that. Your old friend John Daly refused to admit that it existed, even though he had grown up in the middle of it. And so I want to go back and sort of document that stuff, because it's easy to mock, and a lot of it was harmful to students. There's no question that grading people on their level of self-disclosure is probably a bit coercive. And God knows I heard stories of people who would then critique what the students disclosed. Very uncool.
I've heard far worse abuse, far worse.
On the other hand, there was a politics reflecting this, this sort of universal human politics, because the idea was, I mean, there's a certain kind of incredible arrogance. To be a good communicator is to be a certain kind of person, a person who doesn't have hangups, a person who is aware of themselves and their communication, who can be open and honest and engaged and authentic with another person. How do you become that person? We have a 15-week college course for you. Seriously? And so yeah. What I think is that the right way to explain this, I'm giving away the secret of the book that's coming, but you'll all have forgotten by the time it comes out, and it'll be exciting.
More than one.
I think the secret to this is continuous with the American self-help movement, which really goes back to the 1820s and the Methodist camp meetings, where people thought they could renew their relationship with God by going in the woods for 2 weeks and singing songs and hearing sermons and stuff. And they could just reboot the whole relationship that goes south in the course of ordinary living. And that mentality leads to, there's a huge self-help movement in the 19th century. There's physical culture, Indian clubs, gymnastics. There are all these fads, cold showers.
That Raisin Bran.
The Kellogg thing, absolutely part of this whole thing, right? And that was all about masturbation, right? It's clearly something you have to
clearly, help yourself. Clearly about, not, I mean, you know, frosted, you have frosted flakes.
Yeah. So, well, he thought self-pollution was a result of the wrong diet. But it's interesting that Dale Carnegie raised a Methodist. Mary Baker Eddy, founder of Scientology, the ultimate self-help, don't need doctors, also raised a Methodist, right? So there's reasons to think that there's a mentality in America that makes you think that you could change people in this way. And God knows there was, you know, people may have heard of Est, you know, this whole thing in the night, and Scientology actually comes out of this time frame.
Half the people I know in LA are still doing Est. The Forum
still exists.
It's called the Forum. It morphed into the Forum.
Yeah. And fewer lawsuits.
I don't know, but it's definitely still there, man. Every addict I know, oh, the Forum. I'm like, yeah, the Forum.
Oh, thank you for the tip. I will investigate this. So that's the pedagogy piece of it that sort of brings us up to the 1980s, when, you know, sort of modern communication pedagogy is there are communication skills, and you can have a better communicator by mastering the skills and seeing your situation and stuff like this. And so, you know, as you look at that stuff, the civility thing got me going. I guess things always get me going because they piss me off, is that there's a lot of the standard
there
thing.
There are worse motivations now to get into an academic area than anger.
Totally. <Yeah. laughs> I didn't sell out, God knows. But there's the standard academic view of civility now. Civility is bad, it's evil, it's racist. And there are definitely people I meet that when I say I wrote a book on civility, they're like, are you racist? Like, they just ask me straight up.
So tell me about that. Like explain that one a little bit. I get it, but I want to hear you explain it.
Yeah. So, and see, and I want to explain it because this is the thing I wanted to push back against. And so their assumption was that civility is like politeness, and politeness is like being nice, and being nice is like, you hate Black people. Well, that's okay. That's your thing. And you're just nice about it. Right. That's the polite thing to say. It's like, everybody's different. And I actually had a student say that in class once, you know, Hitler and the killing Jews thing. Well, that was his thing. You know, what are you going to say? Like, say it was wrong.
Don't.
He's like, who am I to judge?
Don't do that.
Stop. Who am I to judge? Well, you're an ethical adult human being. That's really? How you get to judge. Yeah. So it's like, it's a sort of stunning moment of that kind of stuff. But in the academic setting, it seemed like it kind of worse than a, you know, a naive undergraduate hasn't quite grown up yet. And so, like, why all this anger about this? And it makes sense within a certain picture of the world and of social change, right? Because if you think that things don't change because people don't realize how bad it is, and if you could just get them to realize it, things would change. Screaming at them is social change, right? So disrupting things. And there are clearly things like this where it worked this way, right? So there's a lot of, there's a new history of the ACT UP movement, right? And so this was the coalition of people during the early days, early-ish days of the AIDS crisis who said the government is just not trying hard enough. And why are they trying hard enough? Because they're homophobic schmucks, which turned out to be not 100% true, but there definitely were gatekeepers who were just like, we don't care. Right. And so they screamed, they made noise, and they went to the Capitol, and they are the origin of the glitter bomb and all this stuff. And they made a lot of trouble, and they were very rude. They got people to listen. Funding changed.
Isn't that cynics? Isn't that right from the cynics, the Diogenes, like yelling at people in public in order to get some, you know, change? Like that's, straight Diogenes.
No. So the, you know, the diatribe, right, is a way of stepping outside of convention, stuff like this. But so the question is, you know, you can diatribe and people are like, yes. You know, what did Woody Allen say? I don't want to become one of those crazy old guys walking around with shopping bags, muttering about socialism. Like, you know, you can be just talking to yourself. Like, is that actually a sufficient theory of social change? Will screaming at people always, will confronting them with the truth about the system? What if you don't have the truth or the only truth? Right. So for a lot of people, that's sort of hard to hear. They think, and this actually is, a lot of it comes intellectually out of a lefty, but it works both directions. Some people want to tell you about Ayn Rand, and they really think if you would just read The Fountainhead, all would be clear. Or it could be Marx, or it could be whatever it is.
My version of that these days is watch this YouTube video. And I'm like, yeah, see, that's not an argument. Like me telling me to send me to a YouTube video is not really an argument.
Yeah, see, they've been reading their APA, argument by citation, as we know from Ben Shapiro. Because he proved this.
Yes.
Actually, it's really funny. Google Ben Shapiro destroys. You get thousands of hits. Apparently, they think that. Not a motive argument I'm a huge fan of.
Yeah, it's an interesting video meme. They do it with stand-ups all the time, like stand-up destroys heckler. Those are the same title. Does it
happen, or just they just like give him a dirty look? You know?
Yeah. It's usually some just responding to a drunk heckler, and that's not really destroying anybody, but...
Okay. And you remember that's how I killed my nascent stand-up career, right? You remember that? You were there, I thought. I went up at open mic night in Louisville, and my material was terrible, and it started to fall apart about 3 minutes in, and somebody said something rude to me, and I'm like, seriously, man, Kentucky, can you even read? And then it just like got going. You were there because you were in the back going, no.
I probably was there. Yeah.
No responding to hecklers. But that was the part I enjoyed. So I realized I was not meant for stand-up.
No, you were perfectly meant for stand-up. You're just ahead of your time. Like when I do stand-up now, I don't even do material anymore. I just talk to the audience.
Is it Don Rickles type talking to the audience or?
No. I want to, you know, for them to say something interesting. And then, you know, I turn it into comedy. Usually not at their expense unless they're an asshole, you know.
Fair, right? I mean, yeah. You could say that's a move from comedy to wit, maybe.
I don't know, like stand-up, like once you learn how to do stand-up really fast, it's amazing how quick you can create like club level stand-up off heckles and off interaction.
I completely believe it. In some ways it'd be more generative, more creative, but in a different way than improv people, right? Like that has a very different vibe to it.
Yeah, very different. Yeah,
I've tried that. That's different.
So
the civility thing, so it kind of drives me nuts because it's like, could civility really be such a terrible thing? And so there's a professor at Texas who made the argument that, look, if you go back before the Civil War, then the Civil War, right?
Well, it wasn't very.
Nah, too many people got killed. If you kill less than 100, it's civil. But no, it's always bad. But so before the Civil War, right, you had these abolitionists going around arguing against slavery, and some Southern people respond, "How rude of you. That is very rude. That's attacking my basic values. You shouldn't talk about this." So her conclusion based on that is, oh my God, civility is always racist. And it's like, well, okay, that was a bad version of civility and it was racist, but I don't know if the general case is made. But the other question is, okay, things are getting polarized. Things are getting weird. The public discourse, right? It always had like sort of a gooey, creamy, vanilla center.
Right. Yeah.
And then weirdness around the edges, which is healthy, right? You should have weirdness because sometimes inside and outside change places. But now the weirdness is all the way to the center. There's no kind of gooey middle where people can agree this is tasty stuff. It's all, you know, habaneros everywhere. And so, like, is this really helping anything? Because as long now everybody is just screaming at everybody all the time. Congress is deadlocked. Everybody is deadlocked. What's going on? So it is hard to know what you're supposed to say at this point in time, because there's two kinds of things. Like, have we lost track of what we're supposed to do? That's one thing. How would you fix the current situation? I'm more in the first camp and then the second camp, right? Because it's easier to describe health than to describe the path you take to get to health once you're already super overweight and haven't exercised in years and all this kind of stuff. So that is one thing. So, but at least you have to start by saying, okay, what would it look like to do this? And basically we wanted to get civility back from the racists, right? So we wanted to say that civility is actually a force for social justice if you properly understand it. So that's the radical claim buried in the gooey vanilla center of this whole thing. So people see, well, civility is just very anodyne, right? It's just like, oh, well, just be nice to each other. Well, no, maybe civility. And actually, there's a quote at the head of one of the chapters from Larry Wilmore, where he says, no, civility isn't just being nice. It's sometimes you got to get up in people's face and yell at them when they're doing the wrong thing. That's also civility. Right on. That is the version of it that we're trying to get to here to justify.
So then is civility a set of behaviors all before violence? Like anything that, nonviolent?
They keep you from getting there. Yeah.
Right. So anything... Are you defining civility as anything that doesn't transcend into violence?
Well, no, there's incivility too, right? Like, so once digits are curled, you're now in a different universe. Like, so that's
fine. You don't swing, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it does. Assault and battery. So if you swing, it's assault. If you connect, it's battery. So
that's what I said. If you don't swing, like if you just tense up and you're ready and you're bringing everybody to the edge of violence, but there's no actual... you know, acting on it, then that is a form of civility, like, you know, of not transcending into the behavior.
Do you do that with your friends?
Every time I talk to them, I threaten them. I'm an implicit threat.
Irony screws with the whole thing. So being academics, of course, we make distinctions in here between weak civility, strong civility, and pseudo civility. So let me say that really quick to get the definitional stuff.
There you go. That's good. I like it.
The weak civility is just the politeness stuff. And basically, it's get along, go along, say nothing. That's fine. You know, somebody says something horrible and you say, how interesting. Or you change the subject or whatever. Okay, at our dinner table, we don't talk about religion or politics. That's weak civility, right? You know, because we want to be able to digest our meal. And if you two actually go after each other because you were arguing about whatever, then you've spoiled the dinner, right? So that's weak civility. Strong civility is the idea that in a mature democratic society, people can develop relationships that are strong enough that they can do real serious disagreement with each other, that they can fight hard. And this was something that actually you can see in a graduate seminar sometimes with the right kind of students, where it's like people go at it really hard. And then afterwards, like, thanks, man, that was great. Right. And you just feel like, and it's like you didn't agree, you're not agreeing, but you don't hate the other person. You actually appreciate it. I sometimes think it's a little bit, you're going to hate this, like judo. So part of judo is the history is it starts with jujitsu. Jujitsu is much older. And when the Olympic movement comes along, the problem with jujitsu is you tend to go through a lot of partners because you break their legs and arms. And so it's not really a sport because you use people up this way. So this guy, Jigoro Kano, he wants to take a version of jujitsu and make it suitable for an Olympic sport. So it calls it judo, the gentle way. But the basic principle is the principle of mutual prosperity. No matter how hard you go, both people should get a good workout. No one's, you know, sort of skill development or workout or effort or whatever is sacrificed to another person's. So if you're the person throwing, you got to work out on that. If you're a person being thrown, you get to work out from that. And so you make sure that nobody gets hurt and everybody benefits. That's actually, and thank you for prompting me. I never thought of that analogy, but that's actually a pretty good analogy to it. You go at it really hard and it can really hurt and it's difficult. But that's also civility, right? There are hard things that we have to talk about. It's hard to hear what other people have to say. Sometimes it's personally incredibly hurtful. It makes you insanely angry. right? The ability to still engage that person, to care enough about them, to have a relationship in which you can engage them. That is what we call strong civility. Our editor at Penn State, after the freaking book was printed, said, so why didn't you call that radical civility? I'm like, well, clearly we should have. That is a great term.
And yeah, it is a good term. That's a good book title.
It sort of captures, you know, so radical civility sounds a little bit like an oxymoron.
Yeah.
And so it has a little bit of a frisson to it. I like that. Well, but I'm willing to go with radical civility.
Talking about a little bit of prescription in it, right? Like that's not just description of what's going on. That's a prescription for here's how we handle all this. Like, how do you do radical civility? Like, what are the techniques that allow you to do that? Like that Zen-ness made me think of, you know, my ex is a marriage and family therapist, and they're taught to sieve emotions, to not absorb people's emotions. But that's something that has to be taught, you know?
Well, and you also, well, okay. So a therapist isn't authentically engaged with the other person, right? It's not an equal engagement. They're the therapist. And so it's like, you can be mad at me if you want, but in my professional capacity, I don't care. That's just a symptom on your part, right? Or it's a behavior that I want to deal with. We want something that's more engaged than that, right? So the techniques are being able to respect the other person, to show your respect for the other person. A lot of people actually are very good at this, right? They sort of walk around it a little bit, but it's interesting because there's like the idea of Midwest nice. Milwaukee doesn't really have that. But you meet, been ruined by Republican politics in this part of the state, right? We're an outlier. But you meet a lot of people from the outlying regions, and even a bunch of people who have political beliefs that are very much not mine, who are actually very good at like, sort of like, okay, I'm going to say something and I know you're not going to like it, but okay. And I don't mean this as offending you, but I still think this is true in general. And could you admit there's a bit of truth in this? And right, that is developing those skills of managing the thing. And actually getting to the point, it was interesting. So my grandfather is from a small island off the coast of Turkey in Greece. And I was visiting 10 years ago. And it was during a time where they had elected a Greek government and immediately collapsed. And so they're going to have new elections in 6 weeks. And so we get there about 2 weeks into that. And so we went to a memory service in the Greek Orthodox Church. Before you pass away, you decide on what Sunday, what mass you would like to be remembered each year. And so we went to a memory service for some of our cousins, and went across you go across the street to the taverna, and there's food and alcohol and all the things you would expect. And so I'm sitting with my cousin, and there's these two guys, and they're like, first they're just like sort of talking. And Greek men, when they go to talk, they take out the beads, right? And so they sit there and they like swing the beads, and it's just like back in the chair, talking like this. And then the beads start to move faster, and then they start to play with the beads. And then it gets louder. And I'm like, so what is this about? And she's like, oh, one guy is KKE. He's a socialist. And the other guy is Syriza, the center left party. And at a certain point, the one guy gets up and he goes like this, and he just walks across the street. And I said to my cousin, what was that? She goes, well, you know, you can only let it go so far. It's a small island. We all have to live with each other, don't we? I'm like,
yes. Yeah, nice.
They took it where they could take it. When it broke down, and then they'll come back and they'll still be friends, right? This is not going to break their relationship. So the problem we have now, I think, is that a lot of our ideas about this are around face-to-face communication in communities where we know each other, right? And this is the point of Putnam's Bowling Alone. If you know people, right? If you're getting up in a school board meeting, your tendency to demonize the other person and say, because they support, you know, a tax plan that you don't like or whatever, and say, well, this is horrible and they're horrible and I've always known it and all this stuff, is going to be moderated by the fact that your kids go to school together, your wives are on the bowling league together, you belong to the soccer dads. Like, you have all these relationships where you're like, I'm not going to burn this person to the ground because we're still going to be interacting. And so I'll argue hard, I'll argue honestly, but I'm not going to crush him or her. That's sort of the key to strong civility, is balancing those things out. And it can be hard to do, right? And so you have all these like tough situations. You're at the family dinner. An older family member uses a word for a gay person that's maybe not very appropriate.
Fabulous.
You say nothing.
Fabulous. They use the word fabulous.
That would be appropriate.
That's right.
in the right setting. I mean,
no, that's 90% of the dialogue on Sex and the City is the word fabulous.
Is that how you know people are gay? Because they're fabulous?
I don't know. I've been rewatching Sex and the City, so it's popping in my head about how often they say the word fabulous. It's constant.
I believe it. But, you know, sometimes older people use older terminology, which sounds disrespectful. Do you say nothing? Do you say something? How do you say something? Do you decide to engage it? Do you take them aside later and say, I need to engage this with you? And say,
smash their face into the potato salad.
Yeah. Or, you know, is it worth ruining dinner? It's like there's a bunch of complicated decisions around. But at a certain point, right, it is important to do this. To do this stuff, to say things to people. And even things like, you know, it goes both ways on the political spectrum too. People say things that are presuming that other people's political views are stupid and wrong and bad. And it's like, that is kind of uncivil. Now, if you want to argue to them that that is the case and you think that there's an appropriate time and place to do that, go for it. That's really good. And, you know, and if you also have to look at, so, you know, 20 years ago, gay marriage was unthinkable. Then it became thinkable and then it became obvious, right? So how do you go through that transition? People have a lot of conversations. They see stuff in the media, they see that things are arguable, then they have interpersonal conversations. There's a whole ecosystem that connects to it. If that ecosystem is well-tuned and working, I think you can get social change. That's an example. And also that, not at all to deny the courage of people who are willing to come out to people and say, please don't say you don't know any gay people because you know me, right? And so a lot of people did that. A lot of people took risks. They broke some relationships, some permanently, but in the process of many people doing that, it became apparent that, you know, everybody knows gay people and there's no reason to hate them because you didn't already hate them. So you can relax now. So that went that way. It's unclear in the current environment if it can go that way. It seems like everything about the means that we mainly use to communicate, Facebook, Twitter, maybe Instagram. I don't know if I want to pick on Instagram or TikTok. Does anybody really send hateful TikToks?
I haven't seen it yet.
I don't know. But Facebook definitely, right? The algorithm and the way that it shares things and stuff, it amplifies, right? The way you get people to share is you make them angry. The angrier a post is, the more likely to be shared or reacted to, et cetera. So anger is what creates attention. Attention creates money. Therefore, we have a system of perverse incentives. So the communication systems that we're embedded in, which they evolved, we didn't choose them. I don't know how you choose. I'm off Facebook 3 years, clean and, don't you say sober? I don't know what you say, but I'm off. But you know, if people don't get off, then what are you going to do? And do people really, after Facebook, because it seems like some of that then translates and they will react to each other in person as if it was an anonymous online reaction.
Yeah,
so it's a lot of stuff to fix.
Like I super curate all my social media. So I completely create an echo chamber. I allow no negativity, no comments from anybody that disagrees with me. And I tell people up front, if you want to agree with me or praise me, then you're allowed to comment. Because that's what I'm looking for from my digital universe.
I thought there was a website for that. Wasn't it called OnlyFans? Isn't that? Or is that something different? I'm not sure. Okay.
Well, there seems to be positive regard on OnlyFans.
That actually, there's a lot of love on there, I've heard as well. Yeah. So there you go.
But go ahead. Yes. There, but I agree. Like I do just the opposite. I don't want to argue. I never argue. I never do any of that stuff. It's all just praise.
But can you really, at some point, can we really engage enough to get on with things? That's the question, because there are problems to be solved and we seem to be completely stuck. So what we're trying to do in this book is say, okay, if you took this strong civility thing seriously, is it consistent with social justice? Is it consistent with some kind of, you know, social change in various ways? Does it allow you a position to critique certain things that are going on? So the former president liked to call names.
That guy? What? Who?
Yeah, he did. I know some of his fans don't believe it, but the record is there. There's a Twitter archive, and you can go and put in the word stupid and just find out that any of the things you want.
Yeah, he called everybody, you know, half the country losers on Father's Day the other day. He said, "Happy Father's Day, even to all the losers,
rhinos, losers, and liberals, or something." maybe maybe someday you'll be on board. I don't know. And so that stuff is just like incredibly corrosive, right? And part of it is what it contains is sets of assumptions about people. It stereotypes people and degrades them in various ways that make it very hard to have any kind of conversation. If the person, you know, is like, okay, here's some evidence I'd like to look at. You're stupid. Like, okay, those two things are not on the same page. They're not the same kind of thing. And the person isn't actually engaging you. And if it just comes down to that, okay, we can just name call until the cows come home, but we're not actually getting anywhere. So the larger picture is, you know, democracy was supposed to be the kind of government that was run by talk, where people would talk to each other. And of course, like the ancient Athenian democracy, people sometimes talk like it was this paradise. Not really. They assassinations and exiles and, you know, they violence was an ever-present part of their society. And that's just for the people they allowed to participate, which is not the slaves, the women, the medics, and all these other people. And so it wasn't a perfect situation at all, and neither is ours, but it doesn't have to be perfect for it to get better. And, you know, one diagnosis is that a lot of our visions about how democracy can work are based in a kind of small town culture that hasn't really existed in a widespread way for about 100 years. Right, 1880 to 1920, America goes from being primarily a rural farm-based economy to a city urban industrial economy. And that a lot of the norms and other things.
Yeah, that was the De Tocqueville stuff, right? I mean, what he saw versus what, if he'd have come back, you know, 30, 40 years later.
100 years later, it would have been completely, yeah, that is an excellent point. Completely different because people's sense of possibility had changed. It was a different set of people. It was a more diverse set of people. And so the whole business with moving to cities is dealing with diversity, right? You have people, many races, and it coincides with waves of immigration. And in the 1920s, people are very worried about, oh my God, these people moved into our apartment building and the food they eat, garlic, oh no. Seriously, people are like, America has been polluted. What will we do?
And it goes back to the, you know, premise that it's pretty easy to do democracy in a, you know, homogenous culture. You know, that's really where it works best. You only have like four things that you're arguing about. Everything else you all agree on. So it's like now, oh my God, look what all democracy has to do. We are now forcing this software to do shit that it was not designed to do.
Well, and what's amazing is until recently, we did it so well. That is what's amazing. Fits and starts, civil war, racism was not a solved problem. I'm not saying it was a perfect thing, but the whole thing held together. And I do take the criticism that the reason it works so well is so many people are excluded from the conversation. Right? Is that's part of the reason that the older style civility worked. And so we're also making an argument in this that, okay, you have to have a version of this that lets lots of points of view in. And there are people, I have friends that I have lost over this book who will never forgive me for writing it because, well, look here, the problem is that civility is intended to be the undergirding, right? The substructure of a system which historically has been essentially racist, which has, this system has managed to exist based on violence toward Black people, right? Yeah, from the slave era through lynching.
Well, yeah, it's hard to argue against that as one of the planks within the system, as the dominant, you know, overarching Death Star of the system. I'm not sure. There's a lot more going on. So,
take it from that person's social location and their life experiences. Sure. That seems like the whole thing. So I want to honor that. I get the critique. But also, you know, there was a book about 20 some years ago by the philosopher Richard Rorty called Achieving Our Country. And he said, look, the point is not that we did it right, but that we have an idea of what it means to do right. And we're still moving in that direction, right? So this is the meliorist, it gets better, you know, sort of point of view. And I do, and certainly people say, well, of course, you're a white guy. You have scraped your way into the middle class. You're a professor. Of course you think it gets better because it got better for you. It's like, it gets better for a lot of people, right? We have to make it get better for more.
I typically don't do a lot of identity politics discussion or analysis just because, you know, it's like standpoint theory and criticism. It's like, yeah, if you want to jump over to a different standpoint, you're going to have a really strong view. There's a lot of stuff in there, but it's it's just built from that perch, and there's 50 perches. So how am I supposed to deal with every perch, you know, all the time? Like, that is not a tenable intellectual system. I can listen to your perches, but I have no desire to jump in there with you because it's not my area of expertise. And so I see this a lot with, you know, like, I think it's a great, the way that you're setting it up, like, here's what democracy was, how, where it was built. And now it's being forced out here. How do we keep it together enough to keep it, you know, viable? That seems like what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, no, completely. It does seem to be coming apart. And it's easy to panic too. We've had bad periods before. The 1930s were bad. And yeah. Partly when I wrote the discussion book, what I found out is part of the thing behind the discussion movement is we have to introduce people to the idea of discussion and discussion as the essence of democracy, because people believe that capitalism has failed. And as capitalism has failed during the Great Depression, right, they're looking to other models. And specifically, they're looking to the Soviet Union. And they're saying, maybe somebody else has this figured out. And so how do we get them to stop looking at these other things, right? And we had Father Coughlin. So there was this this priest on the radio, came out of Detroit, who really didn't like Jews. And he wanted everyone to know. And he knew everything wrong with the world was because of the Jews. He didn't like Black people either, although that wasn't as big a deal. But so, like, you know, the idea of the heinous, you know, a radio person doing this stuff, this has been around before. Things have frayed at the edges. Clearly, the communist persecutions of the 1950s were a horrible period, and people wondered how we were going to survive it. I feel like this is different because the communication system has changed so much.
Yeah.
In the early 50s,
thing. Yeah.
TV was becoming a thing, but TV didn't have the same kind of impact on people's daily lives. People spend all their time on the phone now doing this thing. This is how they do it. They don't, the news is garbage, but they don't watch the news anymore.
Right. Well, right? Even like people, you know, the Ong stuff about paying much closer attention to the transition of your media and your mediums, that everybody acts like cable, like TV should not be part of cable TV. Cable is something completely different than TV. Completely different. There's no way, you know, this stuff would have made it onto Walter Cronkite, you know. There's no way that Trump could have appeared 15 times a day on Walter Cronkite, you know.
No, and this is part of the thing. They are just as much, they're so addicted, they can't even, so this story has come out this week, that Tucker Carlson is source number one for all this stuff from the right and from Trump world, right? And so it's an open secret that a lot of the unnamed sources that give people their stuff, and what'll happen is he'll actually tell somebody something and it's true, and then they'll report it and they'll go, fake news, you're a liar, this just shows the mainstream media, and they keep talking to him. That is the definition of an addict. The fact that, so the most amazing thing since Trump has not been in office is, and been off Twitter really, is that he's not everywhere in our lives now, right? Yeah. They could have cut him off a long time ago. They could have said, okay, there's three things that he can talk about that matter. The rest of it doesn't matter. And we're not covering it. Every time he says, look, squirrel, we don't have to respond to that. They can't do that. Why? Money, right?
Yeah, like, everybody says that. Discipline. Everybody says money, but it's the nature of the medium too. That's what the
nature of the medium is, the money.
It's the economic problem. It's the money, yes, but it's also, it is a fast stimulation game. That's all it is.
Yeah.
Like, I worked in TV and stuff. And even like when you look at stand-up is the densest form of public discourse ever made. It's a joke. It's a laugh every 7 seconds. You can't get denser
when it's good
than that. So what's that?
When it's good.
When it's good. Yeah, always. But it's this idea that it's just chasing stimulation. Money is the end result because people are paying attention. But it's not as nefarious, I don't think, designed as money, money, money. It's more like the medium is running itself now. The people who are in it have to be subservient to stimulation.
I just want to say that, but that comes out of a system where they're making business decisions. Because I guarantee people sat down and said, do we have to pay attention to everything he says? And it's like, if we don't, they will. The eyeballs go there, we lose.
Right.
Sorry.
Same game. But it's important to me, like, to distinguish, because everybody, I read about this today. They're dumping on money running the media. I'm like, no, stimulation runs the media. Money is the result of that. The media doesn't run like, oh, I can make $50 if I say the word, you know,
really? I mean, man, talk to hometown newspapers. Do you still have a newspaper in Austin?
American Statesman.
AAS.
I think so.
Yeah, so many towns have lost their newspaper because there's no money in it. And it's like, the money matters. Why is there no money in it? Because you can buy shit on Amazon. You can.
It's not stimulating. It cannot compete in this stimulation environment. It's not even close.
Exactly. So I take your point that you can flip it and say, if stimulation wasn't the coin of the realm, the money thing would work differently. It used to work differently. If you only have three channels, it's like you have three choices. Watch one of them.
Yeah, and the stimulation value is low and you were okay with it because there was no other option.
And then you have Walter Cronkite saying, and that's the way it works.
And that's the way it is.
Do you remember, were you ever in that conference room on the fifth floor of CMA? So Bob Jeffrey, who was dean, he used to walk by and put a lit cigarette into the mouth of the Walter Cronkite bust. Which apparently was there because it was so ugly. Cronkite didn't want it in his house. So
it didn't look much like him, I'll say that. So here's something I was thinking about when you were talking about this, like, again, using the comedy club as a model of public discourse.
Okay. So okay. Let's run with this.
There's a type of heckler that has to be taken out of the room. There's a toxic heckler and a drunk heckler. They can no longer participate in the discourse. They can't play their role of shutting up. They can't do it. They either want to compete for the turn, you know, and attack you, and you can't shut them down, or they're so drunk they can't tell what's going on. You can't be civil to that person. And so, like, I sometimes look at public discourse now as, like, when Trump came in, I call him a rhetorical Viking. Basically, he just busted into the English countryside where all the monks were trying to be nice to each other and just started cutting off heads. And I'm like, you can't let a rhetorical Viking loose in your comedy club and still expect it to be a comedy club.
My thought was actually a phrase I got from you years and years ago when we lived in Kentucky, which was conversational terrorist.
Yeah.
He takes hostages and he kills them.
Exactly right.
And that was, so there's a point. So this is where it comes to. The big question that people always come to, how do you deal in good faith with people only deal with you in bad faith? Right? When it's asymmetric, because the objection to civility is like, well, what if you're willing to be civil and the other person is not? Like, okay, I'm not, it's a real issue and it's a real problem. I'm not that worried about it because I'm worried about it when both people want it and don't know how to do it. That is the problem that I'm trying to tackle. And I think there are more people who want to, there are people who definitely think and have come to believe that political discourse is just about name calling and attacking and you're one of those and all this kind of stuff. And I have a buddy who says things. He describes himself as a crazy gun nut, Republican, libertarian, Trump loving, like he has a whole string of adjectives and
Christian?
He's a full professor
Christian
too.
In there? Gun loving Christian?
No. Not a Christian. Well, actually, he goes to church because his wife makes him. But you're Catholic. You know how that goes. So
yeah, I do.
I'm sorry. Recovering Catholic, I believe more correct.
No, I'm not recovering. I'm done with it. Jesus had his shot and he blew it.
Really? You got over it? 12 years of Catholic school?
Oh, my God. It's I never even think of religion anymore.
But so he says this stuff and it's just so horrible. But in other ways, he's such a nice guy. And he, if you talk to him about the wrong topic, he just goes full blazes. On the other hand, he can be so considerate and so understanding and so empathetic with people. And it's like, how do these two people exist in the same bodies? And how do I access guy number two on a more regular basis? So the deal is our friendship is founded on, I ended up working in a unit with him. And so we were thrown together all the time. And I realized he was a very interesting person, potentially a huge pain, potentially wonderful. And so we just like started getting together for beers. And it turns out we like some of the same books and we both like martial arts and he likes cars and I don't, but he wants to tell me about it and I want to hear it. And that's great. And so we have a whole substance of a relationship. And so then we get to the parts that are hard, then there's enough respect there. And at one point he's like, well, that's just a bunch of liberal bullshit. I'm like, don't you stereotype me as a liberal. He goes, okay, I apologize. You're truly more complex than that.
Hey.
But you have to work. You have to earn that.
Right. Well, see, and that's what I do on the Converting Conservatives part of my podcast. And I have a subset nonprofit called Convert One Conservative. Like, that's really all liberals need to do is pick one person, and everybody just concentrate on their one person And if we got a 10 to 15% success rate, that we'd never lose another election. But nobody knows how to convert. And so, like in my, I published a book 3 weeks ago from a little press here in Austin, and it's called 21 Colosseums of Persuasion. And it's the idea that quit battling where you're going to lose, move over to where you can get wins. And then if you want to circle back around to logic arena, then go ahead. But like doing relationship building is a clear persuasion win that you can do with people no matter what their ideology is. If you have interpersonal technique, if you know how to
build trust, then
and then you can circle back around, which is exactly what you're doing.
I don't think it has to be manipulative, right? Like I am building trust with you.
It's building an authentically good relationship.
If you have better arguments and there is trust, the person will start to open to them.
Yes.
I believe I have better arguments. So if there's enough trust, yeah. The relationship has to come first.
Like there's this huge thing in marketing, and I try to tell all my clients when they come in, I'm like, it's no longer about pitch and sell marketing. It's not like having a catapult and just throwing your message as far as you can and hopefully it hits people. It's relationship marketing, and you can't fake a relationship. It has to be authentic.
Although sometimes it's like you can push the relationship stuff too far. I do not want to have a good relationship with my healthcare provider. I want them to do certain things.
Yeah, but that's
but they want to have a relationship.
Right. That's the problem is that they don't understand that's a faux relationship and nobody's going to value that. A real relationship, like, you know, State Farm, like a good neighbor. I'm like, yeah, like a good neighbor, except I don't pay my neighbor, you know, $200 a month in case my house catches on fire. You're not like a good neighbor. So if you really want a relationship, act like you're in a real relationship with your customers.
So then it's a matter of defining what is a real authentic relationship like. And that is deeply in the civility stuff. So civility, strong civility is about building relationships that are respectful in exactly that way. And where people are honest, like the people, I've been going to the same people to fix my car for 20 years. Why? Because they do a good job. And like one time I went in and they're like, you know what? Actually, we caused this problem last time. We did something wrong. So we're fixing it for free. You're all good.
Yeah.
That's why I stick with them.
They get you for the rest of your life at that point.
But I think it's honest, right? It would be.
I don't know. That'd be a great rhetorical technique for mechanics.
I'm sorry I told you that then. Here, take one for free. Our fault. But I think they're honestly that way. They try to be, you know, and when it's on me, it's on me. And that's all good. So the trouble is, can you build good online relationships? I think you can. You can be friends with people on Facebook. Oh, no, you can do it. It's a lot more work. You have to be more intentional, more attentive. And there's always this temptation. I noticed when I was on, even with people that I knew well and I had a good relationship with, they'd post something. It'd be like, you know, what's the phrase now? Clap back. You know, what? And it's like, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. You have to remember, you'd never do it in person.
I don't do any of that. I do not participate in social media in that way. I write jokes.
Right. But most people do not have that discipline.
Yeah.
Obviously, you are a disciplined professional communicator. You control it very, very well. Otherwise, that is a lot of stand-up comedy, right?
A lot of it's that way. And one of the bylines for the Rhetoric Warriors podcast and the whole project is, you know, complicated times require sophisticated techniques. Quit going into these hyper-complicated environments with difficult people who are over-emotionally triggered, cognitively compromised, and expecting success with shitty technique.
Well, and there are always the limit cases that there's nothing you can do. And people always present me with, well, what about this? Like, okay, that's a horrible situation. And I have no good answer for that. Doesn't mean my theory isn't good for, you know, sort of ordinary run of the mill stuff, but yeah. Israelis and Palestinians, you know, people who call you anti-Semitic because you criticize the Israeli government's policies. Yeah. They shouldn't do that. That's uncool. Okay. So, well, what about when they do that? Isn't that, it's like, I don't know what to tell you about that. It's wrong. They should stop doing it. They're going to keep doing it. I know why they do it. I get it. I think some of it's sincere, some of it's not. It's just a very unmanageable thing. But the thing is, if those were at the edges and we had a huge creamy center,
we'd be fine. Yeah.
We could manage that stuff, right? And I know that a lot of people, they look at this and they say, like, okay, if you look at the, you know, oppression of various groups, if you look at the level of violence against minority people, both police violence and regular violence, how can you be talking about this? And it's like, okay, look, if you thought that violence or the toleration of that violence was absolutely uncivil, things would be more likely to change, right? Like what I'm talking about is something that requires you, because we describe in the book, the historical arc of civility, it started out with nobles and, you know, the court and this kind of etiquette, but the historical arc is toward greater inclusion and greater equality, toward treating more and more groups of people, bring them in saying, yes, everybody is equal, everybody deserves it. And so if we're serious about that, then there is an ethic buried in this that would challenge a lot of these things. And you'd be able to say, no, actually, slavery is rude, among other things.
No, it's a strong beacon. I mean, it's a good beacon. I think it does a lot if you rescue that and hold it up and let people drive towards that idea of civility, right? It's just like, you know, Gandhi and MLK using nonviolence as their beacon. You know, so it's one of those strong things, like maybe we can't get all the way there, but if everybody's driving towards that, it's going to do really good.
Well, things. And what's really important, I love the comparison to the nonviolence movement, because it's not that violence will never happen. It's that, is violence embedded in what you do as part of your repertoire? Is it, you know, essentially nonviolence is a stance. It doesn't predict the future, but it's a stance you take about what counts as ethical, what counts as appropriate way to treat other people. I mean, I think the natural next place I should go, and fools rush in where angels fear to tread, but would be like, how do you teach this to kids, right? Like, how do you get kids to see that there is a way? And I grew up in a house where political argument was not sophisticated and often extremely hostile, right? Like, I didn't have good models for that. But if I had been learning things at school that, like, okay, so we're going to do these little debatey-like things, and we're going to disagree with each other, and there's going to be a handshake, and, well, not anymore, it'll be a fist bump. That gestures of respect will be done. We will then all have, you know, milk and cookies afterwards, and it's a happy thing. And it's like, you know, if we did this and said this is how it can be, and then you'd also have to point out that stuff you see on TV, some networks, all of Facebook, pay no attention to the man behind that curtain. Like, that stuff, don't pay attention to that. Yeah, that's something that you don't need. And so then essentially our current public discourse is the equivalent of porn.
Yeah, it's unlookable, away fromable.
It's addictive. It's nasty. It's not real life, right? It's all of those things. And so it's like, you know what? That I should actually focus on actual human beings instead of that stuff.
You know, let's finish up here because I don't want to keep you forever, but makes me think of, again, sort of, one of the things I do is yank everything's back over to stand up because it's just an interesting place where the stuff plays out. But like roast battles in stand up. So those are civil. Like, they don't punch each other. They say horrible things.
No, they're not. No. Right, just not punching. It can be words are uncivil.
But right into somebody's face, they are doing the insult culture of, like, somebody like Trump, back and forth. Some of it's, you know, right to the core. Some of it's horrid. But it's all done in fun so that it doesn't blow up.
It's deliberately uncivil, right? So the idea is that since we have a frame around it, that it's all good fun, we can be uncivil and nobody takes it's unserious incivility.
But it does, it trains people to be able to be insulted. And that's the cool thing about roast. Like, if you watch people who are on the roast and being roasted, it trains you to take jokes right in your face so that it is a type of civility training.
I don't know if I would agree with that. I mean, because the thing is, I think you have to take things you don't like, right? Those are meant to be hurtful, right? Like, and I will tell you, I watched a series of, like, best of 20 best of roasts, the Comedy Central roasts. You probably wrote some of these.
I was going to be on Sheen's roast, but I've got friends. That's all they do. But yeah, my buddy's ex head writer, Mike Gibbons, ran the, what's her face? You know, running for governor of California now.
Oh, really?
What's her face? You know,
Jenner.
Yeah, Jenner.
Caitlyn Jenner.
Caitlyn Jenner. And he wrote that, and I was talking to him about it, and he's like, or listening to it on a podcast, and he was talking about that, like, he was like writing the worst things. He's like, no way this stuff's going to get on. And they put all of it on. So he was amazed, like, how far they had taken the gloves off.
Well, it was funny because what I noticed is if you look at the reaction shots in terms of what's hurtful, if people would pick up things about, like, you know, you're fat, you're short, you're a woman, you know, you're a slut is so overused that it's not even funny anymore. Those generally didn't get much of a reaction. But when people would mock somebody's career stuff, like, your stuff's unfunny, that would be like Joan Rivers, like, seriously, I'm coming after you.
Well, you can
98 pounds of terror is coming after you. And so that seemed to be like actually hurtful to them. But it was like, it was weird to watch this because like, this is simultaneously
horrifying.
How often
do you get that experience in our culture where you have to sit there and learn to be insulted? Not very often.
Well, and the other thing to me is it's right on the like, is the person mad? Are they not mad? Is this really all a joke? And they knew all the jokes in advance and they're just pretending to be offended? Or is there some bit of...
Well, they're getting paid. Right? They're getting paid to get insulted. So good money.
It doesn't mean they actually like it.
No, I thought they're actors. They can act like they like it.
The best one I thought was Justin Bieber because people just unloaded on him. And his clapback was surprisingly good. And he's not an actor. Well, maybe he is in a certain sense.
Yeah, he's an actor. Come on, he's a celebrity. Well, cool, man. This is, I mean, really interesting concept. I'm glad you wrote that book. I won't read it, but I'll check out the blurbs.
Great time being on. And I have lots of thoughts on lots of things. I'll come back if you need me to, because I can dish on virtually anything except certain parts of pop culture.
You're good at this. You're really glib. You're fast. You're articulate. You're a good podcaster.
You just said I'm a bad professor.
Did I?
Fast, glib, and articulate. No.
Yeah, yeah.
You're supposed to be like slowly thinking like this.
You're an unusual professor. You're not a non-normative
professor.
The words
out of someplace deep. And
so glad I don't teach that in that context anymore.
You and academia didn't love each other.
You know, I love intellectualism. I actually love teaching, but it's the wrong people listening and the institution is horrific. I don't know how you've done it for as long as you have. Congratulations.
I'm fast, glib, and articulate. Thank you, buddy.
All right. We'll talk again soon. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Get out there and persuade people. As always, they need it.